You're on Books and Arts with Michael Cathcart. We're on air, we're online, and of course you can catch us on your ABC radio app, which is a very handy thing to have on your phone indeed. And today we're up to episode 9 of Australian Portraits, in which radio producer and arts journalist Fiona Gruber and her co-host Angus Trumbull, who's the director of the National Portrait Gallery in Canberra, talk big dreams and big sacrifices. We'll be meeting photographer Ponch Hawkes for a chat about the sacrifices that elite athletes make in order to be their best. But Fiona starts with those doomed Victorian explorers Burke and Wills, failures who've been lauded as heroes. And Burke and Wills are a pet subject of mine, so it turns out that I get roped in to this discussion.
The classical ideals of heroism and sacrifice appealed hugely to the Victorians. But what is heroism and sacrifice really about? Today, we've got two totally different angles on it. Angus Trumbull, director of the National Portrait Gallery in Canberra, and Michael Cathcart, who's wearing his historian hat, deconstruct the cultural values behind images of unsuccessful colonial explorers Robert O'Hara Burke and William John Wills. And in complete contrast, I catch up with photographer Ponch Hawkes and her work on women and sport, which is all about a very different form of glory and sacrifice.
In 1859, three men left Melbourne town, tramping down a dusty trail, headed northward bound. The ground was dry, but hopes were high. Could Burke and Wills be the men? Across Australia, north to south, and make it back again. Where are all the seagulls? Will we reach the sea? We will find those seagulls, Burke and Wills and me.
So Angus, tell us about the sculptor Charles Summers, who created the statue of Burke and Wills.
Charles Summers was that rarity in colonial Australia, a professional sculptor who managed to make a career from making sculpture. It's a major enterprise to raise a statue. And that was, of course, the pinnacle of any 19th century British sculptor, to get the Guernsey to produce a full-scale, sometimes larger-than-life-scale, bronze group. And his statue of Robert O'Hara Burke and William John Wills was modelled in order to occupy a position right in the middle of the intersections of Russell Street and Collins Street, a little way up the hill. And it is a very simple format, a standing figure, Burke, and his companion Wills seated. And Charles Summers obviously devised this group with the model of Michelangelo's Moses for the tomb of Pope Julius II firmly in mind, these great beards, these generic clothes that are out of time, the raising of the figure, both figures, to the scale of heroism with the retrospective consciousness of their tragic fate. This is a group that was intended to be the subject of mythological inspired memory from its very inception.
Michael, you're a bit of an expert on Burke and his expedition, aren't you? Burke and Wills' expedition.
Well, Wills. I know about Wills. I wrote a book about Wills.
Burke and Wills and Landell and King and all these people set off on an expedition. What was the aim? They were crossing Australia.
Well, if they'd been clear about the aim, it wouldn't all have ended in disaster. But in 1860, they set out from Royal Park, and Wills was the navigator. And, well, in one theory, this was a great scientific expedition. They were a great sort of scientific hoover that was just going to suck up information about the landscape and plants and animals and Aborigines. And they had been equipped with every piece of scientific equipment known to man, tons and tons of the stuff. But Burke wasn't interested in scientific information. He wasn't even interested in drawing maps. He just thought he was on a kind of thrill-seeker race to be the first guy to get to the top of Australia and to make it back again.
There was tremendous hope and anticipation about what this might yield. The nearest comparable expedition, Lewis and Clark, through the North American continent, yielded riches, compounding riches, the farther west they went, essentially. the whole process of opening up the American continent was about discovery of yet more vast potential and wealth.
So this was hoped to do the same
in
thing.
In the sense that there was a kind of consistent outcome, the failure of Burke and Wills sort of stood and came to represent in our history the kind of opposite, that the penetration of the continent led to a kind of ghastly realization of desolation, death, and disappointment. And that you get that sense in the mythologies that then come subsequently. So think of Sid Nolan's representation of Burke and Wills. I mean, this is essentially the mindset that descends to him.
But Australians, as you're saying, because Australians had to face the fact that the further west you went, the worse it got, the drier it got, the bleaker it got.
And yet, if Burke and Wills and the rest of them had listened to the Aborigines in those areas, they'd never have died of thirst and hunger.
No, they wouldn't have died, no. In fact, Wills was listening. I mean, this idea that Burke and Wills did not listen to the Aborigines is a myth. Wills listened all the time, and the local Aborigines, the people on Cooper's Creek particularly, the Yandra Wanda, were great chums with Wills. He really understood what was going on. He really bonded with them. It's Burke who loses his cool and starts letting off shots.
Yes, and if you go to that particular reach of Cooper Creek today, as I did some years ago, where we, in a rather appalling lapse of taste, had a very well-catered picnic on the spot where Burke died of starvation,
it is teeming
with life. It's a place where the waters of the Cooper Basin congregate. It's never dry. There's an immense amount of bird life, fish. It's almost an Edenic place.
And even you and I could probably survive there, because I reckon we could make a go of it. How they failed.
So let's talk about the art associated.
Yes, that's why we're here.
Now, this expedition was one of the most painted and drawn and sculpted expeditions that Australia had seen, wasn't it? First of all, there's a big painting by Nicolas Chevalier, who painted them setting off from Royal Park in Melbourne on their camels, and Robert O'Hara Burke and his little white prancing pony about a quarter of the size of everybody else.
Well, this is the representation of the great festival departure from Royal Park.
And yes, as you said, Michael, camels, people in turbans, the crowd looking round, the well-to-do crowd and the poor crowd.
Yes, a very festive occasion. In the bottom right-hand corner, you've got the gentleman of the Royal Society looking very important. And that's an example of portraiture, mass portraiture. They're all there. And then over at the back is the rest of the hoi polloi, the rest of us Melburnians looking on. And, Burke's right in the middle of the picture, prancing on his horse, because Burke fancied himself as a cavalryman. He'd been in the Prussian cavalry. He was very proud of the figure he cut on a horse. So it was beneath him to ride a camel.
And after they died, instead of putting them in the dustbin of failure, Australians embraced them as fallen heroes in a way, didn't they, Angus, with the statue and the posthumous painting by William Strutt?
Well, certainly the commemorative statue by Charles Summers was, to date, by far the most ambitious exercise in public portrait statuary.
What did people think about these failures? I know I keep on going on about it, but they didn't achieve what they set out to achieve, did they?
Why? Because they have to stand for something. Why do we erect monuments to these men who died? And I think it's because we needed to make sense of the fact that the land was dry and it did not welcome the colonial project. In fact, it said, you may go this far and no further. Now, that's an affront to colonial ambition. And what we do in Australia is we erect monuments to the man who did go further into the silence, into the dry, and who died there. They laid down their lives so that there is an investment by colonial Australia in that place of death. We can go there, after all, even if only to die. And I think that Burke and Wills have become apostles of what I call necro-nationalism. And the idea is that this is a nationalism based on death, and it's as if they have been received into a mystery.
And Michael, do you see that as feeding and sort of, in a way, sustaining the kind of 50 to 60 years on, the Gallipoli?
Yeah, it's setting up the mindset for Gallipoli, yes. So that, see, today, we're not that interested in explorers. You know, they're not on the school curriculum. They're not particularly heroes in the Australian
Parthenon. It's very unfashionable to have an idea of conquest of land anyway. It's politically
For political reasons, what the explorers are about is more difficult. But also, they no longer appeal to the nationalists because Anzac just satisfies this necro-nationalist longing so much more completely.
But do you think also it is a strong idea in a Western cultural concept that equates sacrifice with national maturity?
Yes.
Yeah, the shedding of blood, especially the shedding of blood in a young nation in order that it may come of age.
Gallipoli was kind of like the big blooding.
Yeah, it really lands it, doesn't it? And so Birkenwills are no longer required once you've got a horror on the scale of Gallipoli.
Thank you so much, Angus Trumbull. Thank you so much, Michael Cathcart.
Thank you.
Thank you, Fiona.
There are lots of different mythologies associated with Australia, and one of the biggest is sport. We are a sporting nation. We all love sport. We like to kid ourselves that we all do sport. But of course, it's part of that nation-building mythology that all countries go in for and that is represented in all kinds of art. Photographer Ponch Hawkes has created projects over the years exploring sport from a feminist angle and an angle that emphasises effort and camaraderie over triumphalism and individualism. Ponch Hawkes, what are the mythologies that surround Australian sport?
That we are a sporting nation, that all of us are really good at sport, that a sportsperson should be valued above any other, a sportsperson as hero, certainly a bloke sportsperson as heroes. We have very few female sporting heroes. Largely, it's completely male-dominated. I mean, all those sporting mythologies, they go back to the Anzacs, you know, people played footy on the battlefields, and it's throughout our society. It's the way we see ourselves.
And the way that sports people are portrayed in portraiture, in photographs, in images, how does that reflect, A, this kind of machismo, and how does it reflect the idea of winning? Because winning seems to be really, really important in the Australian psyche. It's not, you know, playing the game and taking part. It's annihilating the opposition.
Part of the issue is about the way we see sporting heroes. We think somehow they got there from some innate quality of themselves, and there is some aspect of that. But really, like in all sports, there's this notion of deliberate practice where it takes 10,000 hours to be really good at something. But really, you only get to be positioned of being good in it, both an individual and a team sport, by what I call the love of other people. One, generally the love of your parents who are prepared to get up if you're a swimmer at 4:30 in the morning, take you to the pool 4 or 5 days a week and then pick you up after you've been to the gym at 8. Or, you know, the coaches who work for absolute peanuts to train you, or your friends and neighbours who support you, or your siblings who are sometimes a little bit pushed aside while your parents pursue your sporting prowess. So all of those are what actually happens, but what we see is the hero and the winner. But really, it's much more complex than that.
What are you looking for when you're taking a portrait of an elite sports person?
Well, I think there are all sorts of different ways to do that. I mean, it's endlessly fascinating to everyone the way the body moves through space or in sport, in a high jumper, or the way an athlete, you know, moves on the netball court. I always try to work on the communality of it as well. I always try to look not necessarily for the peak of the eliteness, if you like, but the things that make that person just like you and me, because that's what they are, just like you and me, only they've practiced a bit more. Maybe they had some good genes to balance it off as well.
I think that's a very optimistic view. I know however hard I practiced, I'd never be an elite anything, really. In 2010, you won the Basil Sellers Fellowship, an award that looks at the art of sport and sport in art.
Yeah, I did a piece, an installation. It was called Eros, Philos and Agape, the three types of love. And it was exploring the way love builds up the pyramid of sport that supports that elite sports person. And it was about four young elite sports people and their lives and the lives of their parents. And it had interviews and had objects.
You concentrate on taking part more than winning, don't you?
Yes, I do. But I'm also interested in that moment after you've completed the task, after you've completed the race, or after you've completed the action. I'm interested in that as a moment because that's all part of the process, but not one that's always explored. In 1982, the marathon was not an event that women could run in the Olympic Games. It wasn't until 1984 that we even had a women's marathon. It was thought that women weren't up to scratch. And in 1982, I took photos of the BM marathon in Melbourne. It was the second marathon in which there were a large number of female competitors. And I took photographs of them after they had finished the race. So that moment when, oh my God, I've run 26 miles, and I finished and here I am and I'm still standing. I think I've always wanted to see sort of women as physical beings. I mean, I just admire the physical in our lives, you know, the things we can do, everybody. And I just wanted to make everybody see that women can do all these things as well.
Thanks very much, Ponch Hawkes.
Thank you.
Two very different facets of sacrifice there with radio producer and arts journalist Fiona Gruber and also Angus Trumbull, who's the director of the National Portrait Gallery in Canberra. And all the artworks that we discussed in that segment are on our website with links to other sites as well. And next week, in the final episode of Australian Portraits, it's all about music and meringues. That's a tantalising idea, isn't it? Now, tomorrow on the show, we're going to meet the English writer Jeff Dyer, always smart, often very funny. He's going to talk about his new book, Another Great Day at Sea, and also the comedian Ruby Wax will be in. She's a headline act at the Melbourne Comedy Festival. So we're just coming up to news time now, and then it's Earshot, and today the story of the Vietnamese Zen Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh. Martin Luther King nominated him for the Nobel Peace Prize, so we'll find out his story straight after the news. I'm Michael Cathcart, and this is RN. Bye-bye.